The Guardian.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I meet a marvel of British cinema. Terence Davis unveils his swooningly nostalgic romance, The Deep Blue Sea. And from tales of sexual liberation to political liberation, I meet director Jareth Mertz to discuss his riveting documentary, An African Election. And of course, Zan Brooks will be along as we review Brad Pitt doing the math in Moneyball, the stormy drama Take Shelter, and Michelle Williams inhabits the alabaster skin of Norma Jean in My Week with Marilyn. It's the blonde bombshell of the podcast world. It's Film Weekly. Since his brilliant and critically lauded Distant Voices Still Lives, the director Terence Davis has worked sparingly. Until that is, the cultural capital crown was placed upon his native city of Liverpool, and he was commissioned to create a cinematic poem to the city. Of Time and the City brought Davis's filmic voice back in full bloom, giving him the exposure and the confidence he needed to tackle a new feature, The Deep Blue Sea. The film is an adaptation of a play by Terence Rattigan, whose centenary it's intended to mark, a romance that pushes at the social strictures of post-Blitz London. The film boasts a trio of striking performances, from Simon Russell Beale as the pompous judge and jilted husband, Tom Hiddleston as the returning war hero and young lover Freddie, and from Rachel Weisz as Hester, a woman following her passionate heart down a destructive path and giving the most scintillating film performance of her career to date.
Freddie, darling, would you come home with me, please?
No, I will not. You'll start talking and pleading.
No, I won't. I promise I won't. I swear I won't try to make you stay. I won't even talk if you don't want me to. Trust me, Freddie. I swear.
Freddie, be reasonable. She's given her word, for God's sake.
Will you get my wash things from the flat for me? I'll collect the rest of my stuff when I can face it.
When I met up with Terence Davis earlier this week, I found him in as fruity form as ever. But I began by asking him if it was true he'd never heard of Rachel Weisz before he cast her as the star of his film.
No, I hadn't. I don't see that many modern films because I can't suspend my disbelief anymore. But I was watching television one night and this film was on. I'd missed the beginning and so I didn't know what it was called. This girl came on with these fabulous eyes, and this wonderful luminosity, which is something different to beauty, although she is very beautiful. Anyway, I waited till the end of the film and looked at and it was swept up by the sea. And I rang my manager and said, have you heard of someone called Rachel Weisz? And he said, Terence, you're the only one who hasn't, which is true. So I said, I think she's just glorious. I said, can we send her the script? We sent her the script. She rang me. We talked. I said, if you say no, I have no idea who I'll ask. She said, I'll do it. That's how it happened.
Because Swept by the Sea is a long time ago. I mean, she was very young when she was only about her second or third film, that one.
But, oh, she's even more beautiful now. Even more expressive, I think. Just that extraordinary. As I said to her, I said, you've got the same luminosity that Celia Johnson had, and you'll have it when you're 90. She'll have it when she's 90.
Were you looking for that? Were you looking for, I suppose, I mean, say Celia Johnson, we're talking about a 40s and a 50s woman. I mean, a woman who, let's say Brief Encounter, who embodies all of that passion and can also kind of, you know, can also take it down and button it down and keep it under the collar. Were you looking for that in your Hester? Was that what was crucial? And you were looking for a modern actress that could bring also a modern sensibility to it, because that's what Rachel does.
Well, it's crucial to all of them, because everybody was suppressed in that way. I mean, not just women, it was men as well. I mean, even at funerals, men were supposed not to cry, and if they did, usually their wives would tell them off. I mean, it was something that you didn't do. So it was very restrictive for everybody, and I wanted to get people who looked like the period, although you can't do it absolutely accurate because we've changed in 50 years. But
You mean physiognomy?
Physically, yes, we have changed a lot. You look at newsreels of the 40s and 50s, and they look quite different. They are not like they are now, because we've changed our diet and all sorts of things, you know. But it's important that whoever plays these roles gets that sense of the period of what it was like. Because I grew up in the 50s, and not only did I know what it looked like, I know what it felt like. And that's the big difference. I just know certain things. If you didn't grow up then, you can't know. How can you know? Women did not leave their husbands. They didn't do it. It was, if you were working class like my mum was, you were stuck with this, and you were pregnant every year. And there was nowhere to go. If you were middle class, it was something that you just simply didn't do. Sort of stars divorced, but really they were demigods. They weren't ordinary people. But you did. But that's the thing that is very, very powerful, that here is someone who is very conventional. And she does something completely bohemian. I think that's wonderful. As I was saying recently, it's fascinating that I heard I read a story of Ibsen, who wrote revolutionary plays. He didn't like going to the doctor because he didn't like taking his clothes off. It's very it's very interesting that. Mm-hmm.
You don't like taking yours off as well.
Never.
Calm down, Davis. I know you've got a film out, mate. Anything for publicity. One of my favourite shots in the film is Rachel's bohemian kind of, oh yes, a rhapsody, if I may call it. She says, yes, I'm going to go with Freddie and I shall leave my husband and, of course, for love, I shall do it. Then she comes to Freddie's rooms, the rented rooms in a landlady's house. And for all her bohemian spirit, she wants to kind of throw herself into this life, onto this kind of sofa. But then she sees it and, ew, it is a little bit dirty.
It's awful. And those rooms were, and they were lucky, they have two rooms. Most people had one room. I can remember when my sisters got married, one sister moved into this house on the main road. It was three rooms that this woman had. You had one room each, so there were three couples, and that awful, depressing 20s furniture with that grey, cheap marble. I can still see it. It was awful. One lavatory, no bathroom, and an open gas range on one of the floors, and you missed your rent by a week. You were out. No tenant legislation, nothing. It was utterly hideous, because Britain was completely bankrupt and threadbare. And what people did, they tried to keep what they had looking good, but it was threadbare, and those rooms were dark. So that when you see, say, footage of the mid-60s, early 70s, the colour is so disgusting, because it's bright and it's awful. It's truly awful. But you can understand going to those primary colours after living this grey life. But it was shabby. I mean, everything was shabby. And she tries to make the best of it, but imagine coming from a relatively comfortable background and you walk into that.
There's your poster, which is actually behind you as I speak, is brown. You know, there is a lot of brown in the film. You know, Britain was brown. You are, as you say, you remember what it feels like. I wasn't there. But from your films, I kind of know what it feels like, the atmosphere, that I can smell it, you know, I touch it tangibly. What is it about that period that does so bring out the poet in you, that meant you've spent now, I don't know, four or five films still in the fabric of that Britain?
Well, I think it's because I'm probably trapped there emotionally. Because when my father died, just before I was seven, and I was still at primary school, and I left at 11, those middle period, that was 52 to 56, I thought I would die from sheer happiness. I was so happy. We got this awful man out of our lives and we began to live. We didn't have very much, but like most working class people, no one did. But what we had seemed so wonderful. Simple things seemed utterly, utterly wonderful. I mean, like now, you'd come home from school and it would be dark. And the parlour was kept lovely and clean and polished, and there would be a fire in the grate, and my mother would leave on the grate toasted potato cakes by the fire. That seemed unimaginable luxury. Fruit at Christmas. Oh, I can't tell you. And I was literally sick with happiness. And then my paradise ended when I went up to secondary school, which was an all-boys school. Mm. But that period, and I was also seeing the great melodramas, which were all about women, you know, All the Teflon Lies, Magnificent Obsession, Love is a Many Splendid Thing, that kind of thing. But also the great comedies, people like Alistair Sim and Margaret Rutherford, and people would go and see them, even if there were only one scene, they would go and see them. And, of course, the musical. Some of the greatest musicals were made when I was growing up. And I saw that, you know. I mean, this was such a rich world you never thought would end. Mm-hmm. You never thought would end. And I think that's why it has such a pull on me.
It's a magnificent film, Terence. I'm really delighted that you could come back and talk to me about it. I hope that we can have you again on soon on Film Weekly. Terence Davis, congratulations on Deep Roots.
Oh, thanks very much. Thank you.
He really is a one-off, and the film is too. Terence Davis's The Deep Blue Sea is on general release from this Friday, the 25th of November. And if you want to hear a full, unexpurgated version of that interview, subscribe to this podcast and download Film Weekly Extra, my full interview with the great Terence Davis, complete with classical references and florid turns. Now crawling out the rubble like a wartime urchin, Zan Brooks joins me in the podcast studio. Hello, Zan.
Hello. Shine your shoes, Governor.
Yes, please. The Deep Blue Sea, we just heard from Terence Davis there. Did you like it?
I liked it very much.
I loved it.
It's very much Terence Davis. Mm-hmm. It's probably more Terence Davis than Terence Rattigan, I guess.
Yeah.
It's very glacial. It's brilliantly oppressive. It has this sense of, you know, the impoverished post-war London, whereas Rachel Weisz's character says they can't ration everything.
Yes.
But everything does seem to be on a strict ration. It's sort of, it's, you know, the world of cramped little rooming houses where the wallpaper is pressing in and the sort of the pub that you can barely see people through the cigarette smoke. All of that is very well done. And it's, I think, very well acted by Weisz and Tom Hiddleston as Freddie.
Yeah, very good. I mean, I'm a sort of big fan. I'm a sort of five-star fan. Of
yeah?
It kind of bowled me over and it kind of took me there and I'm sort of marooned in the 50s, like Terence himself, emotionally cocooned.
I thought it was a little stagey at times.
But
you know, it's unashamedly so. And it's a film about pinched lives in little rooms, so how can it not be, in a way?
And it also features the first number one single by a woman, sung by a woman, Jo Stafford.
Yeah,
it's the final song that comes over it. So I thought, that bit of interest there.
That's probably the first airing she's had in a while.
Yeah, it probably is as well. But Sam, we'll leave Deep Blue Sea there because I think Terence kind of sells it well enough himself. Instead, we'll look at some of the other big films this week. It is a sort of mega week in a way. We'll look at Moneyball. Then we'll look at also 50-50, starring Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Then I can tell you about my week with Marilyn. And how about you tell me about Take Shelter?
We'll do that.
As a quid pro quo. But shall we start with Moneyball?
Yeah, let's do that.
It stars Brad Pitt, of course, as Billy Bean, and Jonah Hill as Peter Brand, a statistician who has devised a new method to select players who've been overlooked by baseball's big boys.
I'm projecting that we need to win at least 99 games in order to make it to the postseason. We need to score at least 814 runs in order to win those games and allow no more than 645 runs. People are overlooked for a variety of biased reasons and perceived flaws. Age, appearance, personality. Of the 20,000 notable players for us to consider, I believe that there is a championship team of 25 people that we could afford because everyone else in baseball undervalues them.
Moneyball, based on the book by Michael Lewis, which many sports fans have read, because it is about pitching the minnows against the big guys. And as an Arsenal fan, my manager, Arsene Wenger, is mentioned quite a lot in that book about how he was trying to kind of queer the pitch and take on the monies of Chelsea and Manchester City.
So you've read this book?
I haven't actually read the whole book. No, I flicked through it.
Why break the habit of a lifetime?
Because it's very, I mean, it's interesting. The book is very, very statistical. That's why I flicked through it. I mean, there's tables in it and figures in it. I'm not a big figures guy.
Well, this is the thing, and possibly you almost need the book as a primer to the film, particularly for UK audiences who baseball, you know, is largely going to remain a mystery to anyway.
Yeah.
And this is very much the arcane, you know, the voodoo economics of baseball. It's not the heroics on the pitch. It's the management of it. It's what kind of goes on, the deals and the number crunching.
This is actually why baseball is the American obsession, because it is about statistics. It's not about the people who play it. It's about the fans who actually kind of do number crunch and watch and kind of... And Peter Brand, the Jonah Hill character, really is. He's obviously a fan, a nerdy fan. He's never going to play baseball from the size of him.
You're right. And it's a great performance from Jonah Hill. You know, we're used to Jonah Hill being the kind of, you know, the lovable kind of schlump.
Yeah.
And here it's a very modulated, almost underplayed performance. Mm. Good performance too from Brad Pitt, and more of a conventional role. It's the, you know, it's the sort of the roguish underdog who comes good.
Still, you know, nice to see him though. So often we don't, I mean, even in Tree of Life, he's the lead character. We don't see that much of him. The camera's always floating around. We see his ear, his neck.
Yeah,
his
glasses. He's pretty much in every frame of this film, isn't he?
Yeah, and if you're a Brad Pitt fan, that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. And obviously, if you're an Aaron Sorkin fan as well, who co-scripted this with Stephen Zellian, I think.
They've got big guns on the script.
Big guns. And, you know, I guess because Sorkin was around last year with Social Network, you've got the obvious sort of parallels in terms of, you know, living in the information age and the implications of the information age for the great, you know, cultural institutions, whether that is dating or sports.
Yeah, for me, this was kind of Field of Dreams meets The Social Network. It's about the kind of the dreams of baseball and sport.
It is that.
The number crunching of the modern age.
It is that, for good and for ill. I mean, at times I felt that the two worlds were sort of rubbing up a little against each other, not always satisfyingly. That it's almost like it's an oddly old-fashioned film because it's the underdog sporting movie, but it's in new clothes. It's in the new clothes of the sort of spick and span information age that we're in now.
Yeah.
And sometimes the cut of that seemed to kind of pinch a little bit.
Yeah, I see. Do you know what?
You loved this film, didn't you?
Yeah. I absolutely loved this film. I mean, I know it's 133 minutes.
Yeah, it's
and I
too
thought,
long.
Oh, God,
too
I don't
long.
Fancy this. It whizzed by for me. I love a sports movie. I love a motley crew getting together, the heist caper, kind of Ocean's 11, like all that. We'll get the kind of the odds and sods, the kind of wounded, the kind of, you know, kind of spazzy pitchers who no one wants, the big fat guy who can't get to first base. I love all that stuff. And it did that, but it didn't quite do it in the normal way.
No, it didn't. It did subvert the cliches quite nicely. I thought, though, that where Social Network had this great sort of icy sweep and this almost eagle-eye view, very cold, of this world, this occasionally gets kind of bogged down in the sporting cliches, which are inherent in this kind of film.
I think it likes its sport. It likes
it does
baseball.
Like its
sport. I love the old men sitting around a table, the old scouts who kind of look like kind of old mafiosis.
Yeah.
Their faces, there are many stories.
It's got great
withered.
Texture to it, this film.
Let's move on to 50-50, which is another sort of take on a cliché genre, but subverts it. 50-50 are the chances of survival that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is given when he's diagnosed with cancer and his best friend Seth Rogen is going to help him through.
Oh my God, what kind of cancer is it?
It's spinal.
Lives in the spine.
I didn't even know that was possible. How did you get it?
Bad mattress.
He's joking.
Oh,
joke.
Oh my God.
He still has a sense of humor about it. He's inspirational. It's an inspiration.
Very cute. Can I maybe touch it? Is that weird?
You can do more than touch it.
Yeah, no,
come on.
Touch it.
Oh, that's nice. Really nice.
If I was dying, I'd want Seth Rogen to be my wingman.
Oh, would you really?
No,
oh, no.
Not at all. Go away. I'm dying. It's bad enough. I don't need you going like that, man, dude.
Yeah, he's the sort of Patch Adams of his day,
God,
isn't he?
He's annoying now.
Rolling into the hospital with his jokes.
Yeah, I used to like Seth Rogen when he first came along, the whole knocked up thing. I quite like Pineapple Express.
Yeah,
a lot, actually.
Well, this is the weird, I mean, this is, you know, the bromance gets cancer, isn't it? And you can almost trace the evolution of this subgenre, that, you know, the bromance starts out and it's about getting laid, and then it's about trying not to settle down, and now suddenly it's in the hospital ward.
I know. That's what I quite
like. Poignant.
Seth Rogen stones joking around being rubbish, but when real death is confronted with
you want him to
it's
go
not
away.
Really what I need, is he? And that's kind of my problem with the movie. And a lot of people really like it because it is, I mean, I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt as well, a very fine actor, I think, mucking about in subpar fare at the moment, 500 Days of Summer, I mean, 50-50, 500. What's he got with figures? Why has he got to be in films that have got like numbers in them?
I don't know, but he's very good in this. I think he's
playing
the sort of slightly neurotic, slightly anal radio producer who comes down with
I don't know any
cancer.
Of those.
And, you know, you've got a decent supporting cast. You've got Anna Kendrick doing basically her Anna Kendrick thing from Up in the Air as the ditzy counsellor, who starts out being really annoying. And then eventually you just think, oh, she's wonderful. Angelica Houston as the smothering, the oppressive mum, who's good. I like this. Yeah, I thought this was good.
I'm getting a bit tired of that whole kind of, oh, okay, so it's like that. All right, no, I won't touch you. Okay, you touch me. Okay.
There's a bit of that. It's a lot of kind of tics and gestures in this film. But that's kind of okay, because I thought that there was a sort of heart to it as well. I think it's, you know, a anti-cancer movie. It's based on the real experience of the writer Will Reisner, who came down with cancer when he was working on the Ali G show, and Seth Rogen was his sort of buddy then. So it's all very much based on their life. And he was saying at the time that people tend to take their responses to a cancer patient from bad cancer movies. That's our kind of reference point.
The terms of endearment.
Stepmom, things like that. And this was sort of trying to go the other way. I don't think it really does. I think that structurally it's completely those films.
Yeah.
But the little grace notes, I thought they were very nice.
They go out and have sex. They kind of use the cancer to pull hotties in a nightclub, that kind of thing. But it didn't really subvert that in the end, really. Because, ultimately it's kind of okay, not to give anything away. But, you know, and then he's got his mates, Philip Baker Hall, an actor I really like.
Yep.
It sort of dealt with that. I thought it was trying to be subversive and just what.
No,
was
I don't think it is
line.
That subversive, but it kind of worked for me, and I thought that there was a sort of rumpled, jovial dignity to these people in the end.
Yeah, maybe. I'm 50-50 on it. In fact, no, I'm about 60-30.
Okay.
And I don't know what happened to the other 10%.
You really need to watch Moneyball again.
Yeah, exactly. You do the math then. Tell me about Take Shelter. It was in Cannes. It was in Critics Week. It won at Critics Week, I think. It stars Michael Shannon and the ubiquitous Jessica Chastain.
You know the expenses we have coming up. You want to waste money on a stupid tornado shelter?
I'm doing it for us. I know you don't understand.
You're right, I don't understand! I don't understand half the stuff you've been doing lately! I don't understand you putting Red out back. I don't understand you staying up all night in that stupid tornado shelter.
I saw the first film that this guy made,
Shotgun Stories,
which I felt was hugely overrated.
It was one of the reasons
I sort of avoided this one at Ken.
This is a great deal better. This is a film about, you know, a working class guy in Meltdown, is played by Michael Shannon, who's, you know,
great actor.
Fantastic actor, who's a construction worker in, I think it's probably Ohio. It's a sort of world of flat land and big skies. And he becomes obsessed with building a storm cellar in his garden. He's kind of plagued by nightmares. He thinks that the great rains are coming. And it's basically his story, and it's the story of a working class guy who can't admit maybe that he's suffering from schizophrenia. He's ashamed. He's totally burdened by it. He can't open up to his wife. He can't open up to his colleagues. And it's a tremendous full-throttle performance by Michael Shannon. And in the way of, you know, great paranoid horrors, you know, going back to Psycho, he does that thing where we fear for him and we're scared of him. That he's a big guy and he's obviously burning up with stuff, and at some point he's going to erupt and be a danger to people around him.
Right.
And all of that is very well done.
It's a knife edge kind of thing. Reminds me slightly of from your synopsis and your description and your hand movements. Reminds me of
they don't come across so well.
Was it Kevin Bacon in Stir of Echoes, in which he kind of wanted to bury something in the back garden of his blue collar district of Chicago?
A little bit. I think Stir of Echoes, from what I recall of it, was more of a sort of high concept thriller.
Yeah.
This is more of just a portrait of a man. Although within that, obviously, it does, you know, it puts its finger on a kind of swirling societal unease, I think, of, you know, with the crash, with the environment going to hell in a handcart. The sense that something bad is on its way.
So we're taking our fate into our own hands in some kind of way, but only by burying ourselves.
Yeah, and he's the sort of Cassandra. He knows what's coming. I think that if there's a problem with the film, and obviously without giving too much away, the ending gets a little bit bombastic and makes explicit what works better when there's some tension.
But a full throttle performance by Michael Shannon is probably
tremendous.
Worth witching.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's worth watching just for that alone.
Normally is. Let me tell you about my week with Marilyn.
Oh, wow. How did it go?
Well, Michelle Williams plays Marilyn Monroe. She's here in Britain.
No, it's not quite the same thing.
Not the same thing. But she is doing a Marilyn Monroe impersonation opposite Kenneth Branagh in The Prince and the Showgirl. It's the story of what she did in the downtime between takes. Singing, by the look of it.
Started this heat wave by letting my seed wave. And in such a way that the customers say
Michelle Williams. Now, have you seen pictures of her doing the Marilyn Monroe?
I have, yeah. You know, that's always the problem with Marilyn Monroe impersonators, that they look like Marilyn Monroe impersonators.
You wouldn't, yeah.
I'd look like $100.
I mean, she's all right in the stills. She looks beautiful. She gets the blonde, they get the mole, and you can do that. It's when she starts moving. She ain't no Marilyn Monroe. Right. And it's a kind of
like
big
Jell-O on springs in the famous line from Some Like It Hot.
Exactly, but she's more not. Like she's like she's Marmite like... on a breadstick. Yeah, it's. I mean, she's just not the same voluptuousness. I mean, Monroe is brilliant.
Yeah.
Acting. I mean, what the film does do is sort of say that Monroe, the construct, was a performance, which Joyce Carol Oates' book Blonde obviously does, and many people have done before, and that there was a real girl, the Norma Jean Baker, behind
it. Yeah, and she could turn it on and off at will.
Yeah, and so there's much play of that. She actually ends up having a sort of wild affair, but leading this poor boy, played by Eddie Redmayne, who's just third assistant director, getting his first job. He has to kind of protect her and kind of look after her and make sure she doesn't go off the rails, because she's kind of off, she's having her marriage with Arthur Miller is only just begun, but it's kind of, you know, falling apart before our eyes. So all of that is quite nice. That mythology, that peeking around in the myths of the gods is quite good. Laurence Olivier, played by Kenneth Branagh. The film, however, is just one of those kind of Harvey Weinstein vehicles to make Britain look cute.
Right.
And I hated it for that reason.
Well, when you consider as well that this is fairly the same era as the Deep Blue Sea. I'm guessing it's a very different portrait of London.
Talking to Terence Davies about it, he was saying, well, the movie stars were different. They were demigods. We didn't touch that world. And it is almost a normal man has been invited into this world. There's Vivian Leigh, there's Laurence Olivier.
Sounds a bit like Almost Famous.
It's a little bit, but it's done so dowdily and drably and grey. There's no kind of glamour to it, even though there is this kind of glamour figure in the middle of it, and Marilyn Monroe in the bath, you know, that sexuality. It, for me, it never kind of pulsed with the kind of majesty that it needed, or it never had the sexuality it needed, and she never had the flaws that brought Marilyn Monroe down.
Actors are on a hiding to nothing, aren't they, when they play somebody who's so in the public eye, who's so iconic, for want of a better word. You know, it was the same thing when Will Smith did Muhammad Ali. Yeah. You just think there's Will Smith playing Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
There are certain, there's, you know, maybe 10 people that you just cannot play on screen.
Yeah, she does a fair job of it. And to be fair to the film, it is okay. It's kind of an entertainment. It's a Sunday afternoon. Mm. Okay. I'm very worried that this film will sort of pop up and kind of end up sweeping the board at the BAFTAs and the Oscars, and everyone will fall in love with it.
Really?
And it's that sort of film that the public and the news desk is going to fall in love with, because it gives you an excuse to put a Marilyn Monroe looky-likey on the front pages.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I just didn't think that it worked as a film at all, even though everyone in it is all right. Julia Ormond as Vivian Leigh. Kenneth Branagh, would you be doing Laurence Olivier? I mean, it's an all right impression.
Yeah.
It's not great.
Well, we're at that weird stage now, aren't we, where you've had this sort of sense of the shuffling of the candidates who are going to go into the Oscar race, and they're all kind of jockeying for pole position.
And I feel this one is about movies, the magic of the movies. It's got Branagh watching the rushes at Pinewood and kind of go, isn't she magnificent? And it's just a little bit school play.
Well, also, if you've got a movie about movies, have the artist up there.
Yeah.
Maybe not this.
That'll be, well, much, much better and much, much texturised. So that's my week with Marilyn, which I would rather not spend any much more time with Marilyn at all. Zan, thank you very much for joining us again this week. For all of Zan's musings on the world of cinema, go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film.
This time, once again, when the people's power returns into your hands, never let it out of your grip again.
A highly charged former President Rawlings of Ghana there in a scene from An African Election, a powerful and exciting new documentary that follows the machinations of the 2008 Ghanaian national elections. It's a lot more exciting than it sounds. It's a story that plays out, in fact, like a firecracker of a political thriller. It's the work of first-time director Jareth Mertz, and I caught up with him in London earlier this week to find out more. Jareth Mertz, welcome to Film Weekly. How lovely to have you. Returned from what looks like a stormy African election in Ghana there.
Thank you very much for having me. Very, very stormy African election, you know. And it wasn't even predictable in that way. That's the key to me. It was like, what a surprise of an election, you know, that seemed to be fairly, you know, decent, nothing too exciting, turning into a political thriller, basically. And going into like an unprecedented second rerun.
Yeah, it was like a, you know, watching a football match going into extra time and penalties. I didn't know politics could be quite exciting. I mean, you say it was unpredictable. Presumably, you went out there hoping it would be unpredictable as you were documenting it.
You know, I knew that I'm documenting these elections because I wanted to give viewers something they hadn't seen before. So it wasn't about how exciting is this going to be. But that being said, as a filmmaker, you catch yourself being like, so when is the nitty-gritty going to happen? Mm. And then you have to let go immediately because you're undermining, you know, because then you're looking for the cliché. But the cliché did come to haunt us. But fortunately, it was only there to be proven wrong mm-hmm. in the film. You know, it turned out to be a success.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like, in a way, Garner wanted to prove that it could do a smooth electoral process and show the world that, you know, African politics is a democracy and it is working very well. But what is thrilling about your film is the thin line between chaos and democracy.
Absolutely true. And I think it's a reminder that even though Ghana is the beacon of hope, you know, when it comes to democratic progress in sub-Saharan Africa, that you must not, and we must not take it for granted, that little things can upset all the work, the hard work that has been done to move ahead and to stabilize, you know, this culture of democracy. In Ghana's case, I think what was so unique is that the people made it work in the end. I always make this example between the 2000 elections, Bush versus Gore, where in the end, the Supreme Court took matters into their hands and they decided, versus Ghana, the Electoral Commissioner handing it back to the people and saying, you go back, even if it's just a remote district somewhere in the boondocks, but you will finally, the people will decide the future of their country, you know.
So elemental about the politics that you cover in Ghana. It is, you know, one person putting the vote in. It brought it back to what I suppose we in the West get so sophisticated with our computer predictions and, you know, so much so that, you know, you mentioned Bush and Gore, you can't separate them. You mentioned even here in the UK, we have a coalition government because, you know, you can't separate these people. No decisions have been made. It is literally, you show us, it's almost like the beans are being counted here in Ghana.
Well, the beautiful thing is that as the polls close, I mean, even prior to that, people are celebrating. They're out in the streets. They want to be part of the process. They're not just handing it over to, like, a mechanical process. Yeah. They're there. They're counting. You could see people dancing in the streets and then in unison, like a choir, you know, counting the votes. It was music. You know, it was electrifying. It's just beautiful the way that people are passionate about having an impact on a process. Yeah. Yeah. You know, we've become a little bit jaded, I think, and cynical.
Is that what you went there to find? Why you? Why Ghana? What were you doing there?
I was looking for a piece of myself, I guess. You know, the film, the idea of the film was going back, you know, down memory lane to see where I'd grown up and you know, becoming more in touch with my African heritage, so to speak.
What is your African heritage?
Well, my biological father is Nigerian, but I grew up with my Ghanaian father, and he's half Swiss, half Ghanaian. I was born in Switzerland. I just needed to go back to the place of my childhood memories.
The obviously the hero at the time, the well-known man at the time, was Rawlings, who's Jeff Rawlings, who's kind of a huge kind of figure in African politics, and you get very close to him to see. I hadn't really heard of him in recent times, and he's obviously still a massively popular, charismatic figure. I mean, he's like a heavyweight champion, the way he kind of punches the air.
Oh, that's a nice picture you made there. He is. He's a heavyweight, and he's a champion. And, you know, people might not like his politics of the past, but one thing he did relinquish power, which seems to be a disease in Africa that the leaders do not want to let go. You know, look what happened to Gaddafi. That could have been the same with Rawlings. But, he handed over power. I think it's very commendable. But, yes, he has. He commands the masses. He's a populist. He's a rock star. He's a Che Guevara of Africa, so to speak. And he's still a very, very great influence in the country to this day.
And you manage to get close to him and follow him around. You get that crackle, that electric kind of danger of being in proximity to him. That you do an interview with him in a car where you're surrounded by people. It must have been thrilling.
Very thrilling. And I think something about him is that he is a man of the people. You know, he doesn't travel with, you know, here we are in his car driving through the capital. Windows open. There's no security people with him. Mm. So he let us very close, you know, and he understood, I think, what we were doing. And but I must also say my brother, he traveled with him a lot and became like the fly on the wall. And he had some of the most intimate shots of him, you know, him sleeping in the car, him being at home, you know, looking very worried and making phone calls. It was a gift. I don't know how we managed to, but my brother managed to really get so close to him and build that trust.
So an African election, it is obviously going to be a metaphor for greater things, for across the continent. We know that Africa is well known for corruption in politics, for dictators. You mentioned Gaddafi, but you could equally say Mugabe, you could say whatever it is. You say that Ghana is a beacon of hope. You've covered now politics, I suppose, in its kind of rawest form, following those around in Ghana. Do you hope that can spread the rest of Africa, or do you think the system that you've seen is so open to kind of corruption and so open to, I suppose, misfiring in a way, just human error, that perhaps it needs another system?
You know, the culture of democracy, we often talk about emerging democracies in Africa. I think that's a misconception, because there's ancient democratic forms that exist, you know, pre-colonial times. I think it's reconnecting with a lot of those and bringing them up to speed in time. There's of course the challenge that a lot of the politicians are so out of touch with the people and don't represent the interests of the people. But I think what is happening generally, and the film hopefully will inspire, is that people, you know, the masses are taking the power into their hands again, and that you cannot get away as a dictator or a politician as you used to. It's impossible nowadays. People are watching over you. Kenya, Zimbabwe, we showed the film there. People said, please, in Kenya, come back. We're voting next year. Yeah. We need to show this film that people understand, yes, there are challenges. The system is not perfect. You know, we have to work on the system because democracy is a work in progress. But bring the film back so we can reach out to the youths, to the politicians, you know, and inspire them to be transparent and serve, you know, the needs of the people.
You say it might be inspirational in Kenya and Zimbabwe, but you know what? There's enough apathy in the Western world for elections as well. We have rioting on the streets. I don't know if people vote. Sometimes your film made it a lot more exciting than watching, you know, Peter Snow do a swingometer and have that abstract politics of which counties of this and that. You know what I mean? It was elemental. It was like, let's get out and vote. People fight for this vote, and it got back to that. So inspirational, actually, maybe more in the West, you know?
Well, I hope so. I hope that the West can learn from this, or not even learn, but, you know, be inspired and be less cynical, and we realize how fortunate we are.
Jareth Mertz, congratulations on your film. It thrilled me, and as I said, I've used the word thrilling a lot, but it excited me and kind of energized me, and I wasn't expecting that at all from an African election, and congratulations on that.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, you know, because I think the challenges we face that is that Africa needs success stories. They're there, but they need to be told.
And Jareth Mertz's An African Election is on UK-wide release from November the 25th. The music we've been featuring on the podcast this week is from that film, a combination of the great score by Patrick Kist and the majestic Afrobeat of Ghana Bar, the musician formerly known as Guy Warren. Do remember, if you want the inside track on the film industry, pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday, where my trailer trash column gives you everything you need to know. But until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, he's back, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS. Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.